issue of Ukraine, NATO, and Putin had more punch than they expected. Foreign policy, people say, doesn't matter to American voters, but I'm not so sure when it's something so fundamental as, you know, the largest ground war in Europe in 80 years and NATO as an alliance and Putin and his brutal invasion. So I think that issue could be is one where Haley voters naturally can find it easy to support President Biden. Biden's not going to change his views to reach out, and he shouldn't, his policies to reach out to any particular, you know, subset of voters. But this is one on NATO, Putin, foreign policy in general, I'd say, even where there's a pretty close, pretty big overlap between the Haley voters and the Biden administration.
And here's where I put you on the spot as a person who has made your distaste for the former president clear and has, for many, many, many reasons. Are you going to vote for Joe Biden?
Oh, yeah, I am. I did last time and I did some work for him and I'll do that again this time. But the key is the former Trump supporters, I think, and Trump administration members whom you mentioned, getting them out there. Look, I've been against Trump since 2015. I don't have that much credibility perhaps with those swing voters anymore. But I think the what people who do are people who said, I voted for Trump twice, or I worked for Trump and I saw him up close. And that's where Mike Pence and Mark Esper and people like that are so important.
And before we let you go, do you still consider yourself a Republican?
No, not really. Not really. An ex-Republican. What did Pete Buttigieg say in 2019? He wanted the votes of Democrats, independents, and future former Republicans.
Okay.
So, can you be a future former Republican forever? I doubt it, but I'm a former Republican at this point.
That is conservative writer, former Republican Bill Kristol, who served in the Bush, George H.W. Bush and Reagan administrations. Mr. Kristol, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Israeli forces have withdrawn from Gaza's largest hospital complex after a two-week battle.
Israel said that battle was necessary because Hamas forces had regrouped there. Meanwhile, in central Gaza, Israeli airstrikes killed four people, including two journalists, in another hospital complex. This all comes as the International Court of Justice, the main judicial body of the UN, is ordering Israel to allow more aid to enter Gaza. The court says famine there is no longer imminent. It has already set in. Israel denies that.
NPR's Jane Raff joins us now from Amman. Jane, what happened with the strike on the hospital in central Gaza?
The UN's health organization said it had a humanitarian team at Al-Aqsa Hospital at the time. It says during the airstrike, its staff weren't hurt, but four other people were killed. Now, Israel called them precision strikes on a command center of a militant Hamas ally. But Gaza's government media office said the Israeli airstrikes killed a journalist and a photojournalist. The Committee to Protect Journalists says at least 90 Palestinian journalists and media workers have been killed since the war in Gaza began. But also, Israeli forces withdrew yesterday from another hospital complex, Al-Shifa, following a two-week assault. The UN's World Health Organization says at least 21 patients died during that military operation. Gaza health officials say they were prevented from evacuating patients and staff from the badly damaged complex, where there's already a severe shortage of medicine, medical supplies, and even drinking water. Israel says it was not responsible for any patient deaths.
Okay, so let's get into living conditions in Gaza. Israel says that it is denies that it is blocking aid. So then why are people starving and patients going without basic care?
Well, simply, according to UN and other aid agency officials, as well as the U.S. government, not enough aid is being allowed in. The U.S. has been pressing Israel to open more border crossings. Israel and Egypt control the Gaza borders, and Israel has imposed extensive restrictions, it says, to ensure weapons aren't getting through. So the upshot is that now only about half the number of aid trucks compared to levels before the war are being allowed in by Israel, according to UN officials. And the UN's International Court of Justice has ordered Israel to allow more aid, although that court has no way to enforce its order.
Any way to know how many trucks are waiting to enter?
Well, it's difficult to get specific numbers, but most aid officials say several thousand trucks are waiting near the border with Egypt. A Jordanian security official told me in March that satellite images showed 30,000 trucks waiting to enter Rafah, including in holding areas. Over the weekend, he still insisted that's the case. But most aid officials say the figure is substantially lower. Estimates generally range from between 3,000 to 7,000 trucks waiting. The World Food Program and its partners say they have enough food to feed everyone in Gaza. It's just not being allowed in. And they estimate that at least 500 trucks a day would need to enter. Right now, it's about 200 a day.
That's NPR's Jane Arap. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A federal wildland firefighter is facing criminal prosecution after being arrested by a sheriff in rural Oregon. The incident stemmed from a controlled burn, a key wildfire prevention strategy that spread onto private land. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports on the latest clash between federal land managers and rural Westerners.
In the fall of 2022, the U.S. Forest Service's Ricky Snodgrass led a controlled burn near a highway in the eastern Oregon mountains next to private land. Snodgrass is not giving interviews, but Max Alonzo with the union representing federal workers says nearby landowners started causing trouble, taking to the road in their pickups.
They were swerving in and up out of the road. They were acting like they were going to hit people that were trying to perform this prescribed fire.
The burn boss, Snodgrass, called the police for help. By the time the sheriff arrived, the fire had spread to private land, burning about 20 acres, and he ended up handcuffing Snodgrass and arresting him. Now, it's not unusual for a prescribed fire to accidentally spread to private land, and landowners are typically compensated, but an arrest appears unprecedented.
There are federal protections for federal employees doing their jobs. Honestly, the sheriff should be charged with interfering with federal work.
A plea hearing was scheduled for today, but Snodgrass's lawyer, with the help of the Department of Justice, got a delay. Now they're trying to move the case to federal court where the charges could be dropped. Sheriff Todd McKinley declined an interview request, citing the case being in pre-trial, but Grant County leaders say the arrest is being overblown.
One man doing his job kind of caused the other one to have to do his.
Grant County Chief Executive Officer Scott Myers says the weather conditions that day probably weren't favorable for a burn, and it damaged private property.
You know, it's an accident, and you can't predict accidents, but I think you can prevent them to some extent.
Now, the setting of this arrest can't be ignored. Eastern Oregon has a long history of mistrust of the federal government. Grant County once petitioned Congress to take control of all the federal lands inside the county. They also once voted to keep the UN out of Eastern Oregon. Steve Ellis spent much of his career with the U.S. Forest Service in the region.
Back in the early 1990s, public land logging was all but shut down in that area. And it resulted in a lot of economic frustration. And they've run fairly high ever since.
In 2016, during the armed occupation of the nearby Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, militia members were traveling to Grant County to meet with supporters when they ran into a roadblock. One, Lavoy Finnicum, was fatally shot by law enforcement.
Go ahead! Put the bullet through me!
But Grant County Chief Executive Scott Myers says generally relations between the county and federal land managers have gotten better.
And we get labeled a lot to be a whole bunch of gun-toting, pickup-driving, crazy maniacs out here, and I don't really think we are.
Still, federal workers say the Oregon arrest is casting a chill over a vital wildfire prevention program that's already under scrutiny. Again, Max Alonzo of the Federal Union.
And now you're expecting them to go out and possibly get arrested for doing their jobs. I mean, who wants to do that?
A decision on the Snodgrass arrest case is likely months out. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us. It is 8:19 on this Monday. Still plenty more to get to this hour here on the program. We're going to hear a story about Nebraska, where some manufacturers are looking to address labor shortages by providing training for newly arrived migrants and refugees in their native language. Plus, we'll hear about those crew members who are still on board the Dolly in that Baltimore harbor. That's all ahead on WPR.
Artificial intelligence, business model blessing or business model curse? while companies do want that high-level AI talent, they're also thinking that they can upskill or help reskill their existing staff.
I'm Kai Rizdal, AI, HR, and what happens next. That is next time on Marketplace.
Join us for Marketplace tonight and each weeknight at 6:30 after All Things Considered on WPR.
Support for WPR comes from Portabella Italian Restaurant, featuring Italian dinners, including pizzas, pastas, and seafood, with a casual romantic atmosphere in three distinctive dining rooms at 425 North Francis Street, Madison.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the city of Kenosha now has a kiosk located just inside the west entrance of the municipal building. It can be used to buy bulk waste, waste tire, and appliance stickers. It also processes park rentals. More at kenosha.org.
Wisconsin Public Radio. In weather, clear to start the day, but a chance for some rain in southern Wisconsin later this afternoon into tonight, with highs in the 40s across the state. Precipitation again tomorrow. It'll be a wintry mix. And then tomorrow night, looking at some snow, 2 to 4 inches possible in the east. Northeastern Wisconsin could see a bit more. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Drexel University, whose cooperative education program is designed to empower students to explore future careers and discover their ideal profession before graduation. More about experiential education at drexel.edu. From C3 AI, C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems using any LLM, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. C3.AI. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And Amy Martinez. Dystopias are out. At least that's the hope of one TV producer who believes we need more hopeful stories about the future. After all, she says, how can we get to better futures without imagining them first? Here's NPR's Netta Ulaby.
The word this producer prefers is protopias, not dystopias, where everything is awful, and not utopias, where everything is perfect, but in kind of a menacing way. Protopias, says Catherine Murdoch, promote a more realistic, better tomorrow.
The whole concept started actually when my daughter, she told me she didn't think there was any hope for the future. And I was really upset by that because I had been working on democracy and climate change issues for such a long time.
Murdoch married into the Murdoch family. Her husband, James, is Rupert Murdoch's most liberal son. She's also a dedicated climate activist, a trustee of the Environmental Defense Fund. She told her daughter there are people working to find solutions.
And she still thought that her future looked bleak, and I couldn't understand that. And she said, well, look at the YA books, all the young adult books are about dystopias. Look at the television shows, look at the films. Everything about the future is dystopian. It's much, much worse.
For years, YA has been dominated by stuff like The Hunger Games.
It's a bloodbath. They're trying to pull you in. That's not your game.
And pop culture's still stuck on zombies, as in The Last of Us.
Run! Find cover! Don't look back! Run!
Murdoch wanted to prove her daughter wrong.
And I went on a journey to look for something that was more positive, and I was unable to find it. Really, the last time that we dreamed about a better future was Star Trek. It was 1964.
Space, a final frontier.
You can nitpick Murdoch's thesis, but aside from Star Trek, it is hard to argue there are many well-known books or programs showing even a semi-imaginable better future.
To boldly go where no man has gone before.
Even the later Star Trek, she says, do not necessarily speak to the crises of the moment.
And we don't have anything that's dealing with climate change, with democracy, with AI, and all the problems that we have today.
We've done an excellent job of scaring ourselves with stories about what could happen if we fail to save the planet. Look, says Murdoch, at movies like The Day After Tomorrow.
A wall of water coming towards New York City.
We've done a less good job of showing what the world would be like if we do act.
So Murdoch founded a production company called Futurific. It's focused on telling these stories. Its first TV show premieres April 3rd on PBS. It's called A Brief History of the Future.
As the old ways break down, fall apart around us, what does it look like to reimagine what comes next?
The documentary series is hosted by a futurist, Ari Wallach. He travels the world to meet people finding solutions, like a Dutch entrepreneur named Boyan Slat, who runs a group called the Ocean Cleanup.
We have interceptors now in 11 rivers, some of the most polluting rivers in the world, and we believe we can stop most of the world's plastic emissions from leaking into the ocean.
The series also has stories about training AI on the best of humanity, not the worst, a story about the cleanest waste-to-energy power plant, and a company on the cutting edge of using virtual reality in healthcare. The common thread, innovation and hope.
If you look at history, everything that we now take for granted used to be impossible at some point in time. So,
this is great, very hopeful. But it's on PBS. I asked Catherine Murdoch if she thought it would reach the audiences that need it.
What are the chances that a futuristic production could end up on Fox? Well, most of the entertainment assets were sold. So that actually it would be Disney. And I think that would be great.
What is next for Futurific, Murdoch says, is a series of graphic novels, a famously dystopian medium. They might get adapted into protopian shows or video games. Murdoch admits it can be hard to compete with dystopia's perverse allure.
It's sort of thrilling to think of yourself as, oh, I'm going to be the lone survivor in the apocalypse. But, you know, I think there's actually something to be said about civilization.
And if we can use romantic comedies to idealize getting married, why not use science fiction to dream forth a more positive future for everyone?
We can do better. We can imagine a better future and work on it together.
But it's surprisingly hard, Murdoch found, when you ask people about the future to get them to talk about what they want it to be like, as opposed to what they do not want it to be like.
Even when you repeat the question several times, they would still come back to, well, I don't want this. And so you have to actually get to a point of, well, what do you want? What does it look like?
And what we can do right now.
We have to ask ourselves, in this moment of complexity, what is it that we want to see happen? Where do we want to go?
And, says Ari Wallach, how we can become the ancestors our great-grandchildren will need. Neda Ulibi, NPR News.
Now, the story you just heard is true, and I feel like I have to emphasize that because today you're probably on guard for April Fool's pranks.
Yeah, Morning Edition decided a few years ago not to produce any tall tales on April 1st. Something about fake news not being such a fun idea anymore. Anyways, NPR did have a long tradition of trying to fake out people on April Fool's Day.
There's a time we told you about Starbucks building a coast-to-coast coffee pipeline.
The water comes in from the mountains, and at the precise second the beans are roasted and ready, they're added to the water in the centrifuge, and off they go.
They have a plan to divert this slurry into individual homes.
Who would believe that? We also try to convince you that there were people who long for dial-up modems again, the slow internet movement.
The heart rate slows down, the thinking improves, the complexion improves. It's just amazing what it'll do.
And the whole perception of time, I guess, shifts as you slow down.
Well, that's a very interesting point. While we can't actually lengthen the human life, we can certainly make it feel much, much longer by slowing down the internet.
Okay, I knew that was fake. We brought you news of a sagging market for maple syrup and neglected trees so full of sap that they were exploding.
An untapped tree is a time bomb ready to go off.
Watch it. Be careful there.
Good to hear Robert Siegel's voice there. Now, those are just a few of the many examples over the years. But as we said, we're done with all that. So no more fake stories on April Fool's Day. We promise.
Maybe.
Probably.
Maybe. This is NPR News.
Schools across the country are wrestling with staffing shortages, and the politics around education are not helping.
My teachers are tired of getting yelled at by people and disparaged and, you know, attacked, and then, you know, for what?
I'm Elsa Chang. We hear from several school teachers on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news with Brady Carlson from 4 until 6:30 today on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Good morning. Glad you're with us for Morning Edition on this Monday here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It is, yes, April Fool's Day, the 1st of April. News from NPR and WPR starts next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Lawmakers say last week's bridge collapse that forced the closure of the Port of Baltimore could impact the local economy. Democratic Congressman Glenn Ivey says the temporary shutdown could hit the supply chain hard and possibly increase prices for everyday goods.
It's going to cost more to ship things to this region, potentially. And so, people need to be prepared for some increases in some of the things they're paying.
It's still unclear when the shipping channel will reopen. In the meantime, the Small Business Administration is rolling out disaster loans to help businesses impacted by the port closure. Police in Dallas say they want to speak with Kansas City Chiefs wide receiver Rashee Rice about a multi-vehicle crash that left two people hospitalized on Saturday. Attorney Mark Lenahan represents one of the victims.
Two vehicles going way too fast on a highway at 6:30 at night, filled with families and everybody else just trying to get home and get to meals and be with loved ones, doing their daily business. These people thought they were too cool for all that.
Police say two cars, including a Chevy Corvette registered to Rice, were racing on the North Central Expressway when they lost control, causing the crash that involved four other vehicles. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. Democratic Governor Tony Evers has vetoed a $3 billion Republican tax cut proposal as promised, along with other GOP proposals that would have set a number for wolves that can be hunted every year and banned political loyalty pledges for higher education employees. In total, Evers vetoed 41 bills Friday that were passed by the Republican-controlled legislature. He also signed a bill that would provide $400,000 to support Holocaust education in Wisconsin schools. Evers also signed a measure that allows for the charging of fees to redact recorded audio and video content provided under open records requests. Media organizations and advocates for open records oppose that. Wisconsin universities are asking prospective students to be patient with federal financial aid process this year. After months of delays, schools are finally receiving the data they need, but records are coming in slowly. Susan Tierink works in financial aid at Marquette University. Her office has a little more than half the number of the records they usually have this time of year, and many of those have errors.
It's very difficult to know what to do, and we have no answers. And we know families are anxious and we want to help them.
The university hasn't sent out any aid packages yet. The delays started when the free application for federal student aid got a makeover ahead of application season. The new rollout's been plagued by errors. The U.S. Department of Education says it has processed more than 1.5 million applications so far, but an estimated 17 million students filled out the application forms this year. As Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race heats up, Republican candidate Eric Hovde and Democratic incumbent Tammy Baldwin are using notably different campaign strategies. So far, Hovde has used national issues like inflation and the southern border to attack Baldwin's support of Democratic policies and President Joe Biden. Baldwin has focused more on framing recent Democratic policy wins through a local lens, including the impact of the infrastructure bill on Wisconsin jobs. UW La Crosse political science professor Aaron Chergosky says both approaches are tried and true, but he also says a Hovde embrace of former President Trump could draw in rural Republicans while also alienating his support in suburbs around Milwaukee and the Fox Valley. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Langlois Foundation, supporting justice, equity, and opportunity for all people to foster and sustain safe and healthy communities. Learn more at langloth.org. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. It's been nearly a week since a cargo ship crashed into Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge, causing a catastrophic and deadly collapse that killed six construction workers. And while cleanup efforts have since started on the Patapsco River, crew members of the cargo ship Dolly, along with several other ships, remain stuck in the harbor. So how are they doing? To answer that question, we're joined now by Reverend Joshua Messick. He's executive director of the Baltimore International Seafarers Center, a nonprofit that provides support to seafarers in Baltimore. Reverend, what have you heard from the crew members on the Dolly as well as the other ships?
Well, precious little from the crew of the Dolly. I am in contact with them over WhatsApp, but their answers have been generally brief. I imagine they're trying to be very careful about how much information they provide, what they say, and to whom. But all in all, the crew is healthy. They're being provided with everything they need, and they're assisting in the efforts with the Coast Guard and Customs Border Protection, the Army Corps of Engineers, everyone that's out there working right now.
Are they doing anything on the ship? Are they working at all?
Yes, they are still a functioning vessel despite the damage they received. So the crew are keeping watch and are assisting actively with the efforts of recovery.
That's got to be so strange to be on this ship with a bridge on it, with everything that's happened, and still trying to go about your daily workday.
Absolutely. Until the vessel is considered exceedingly unsafe for them to be on there, they will remain on and continue to do the work that they have signed on to do.
Wow. What kind of support and resources do people on the ships need?
It depends on the ship. Each shipping agency and owner is different. Each crew is provided for in slightly different ways. So they all have adequate food, and my job is to make sure that continues, that none of their rights as human beings or seafarers are violated, and that they continue to get all of the support they need. Right now, my primary focus is to supply emotional support, trauma care, and transportation ashore for those seafarers who are able to leave.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you about that because, I mean, specifically the crew members on the Dolly, considering what happened and how things turned out, I mean, how have they been handling or trying to deal with this tragedy? I mean, are you concerned about their mental well-being?
I am very much concerned about that. They did not have Wi-Fi on board until Saturday morning. I was able to get them two Wi-Fi hotspots. And I had mixed emotions about that because on the one hand, they really need to be able to connect to family and friends at home. But on the other, I'm anxious about the conspiracy theories and all of the things that are being said about them unfairly out there. So I'm glad that they're able to have Wi-Fi now. I just am anxious about what their emotional reaction will be.
Reverend, just a few seconds left. Any idea when they'll be able to get off the ship and what happens to those crew members after that?
No. A lot of that depends on when they're able to get the ship free from the bridge and back to its berth. And then the crew's future is relatively uncertain. Hopefully they'll be able to remain aboard and I'll be able to care for them as long as possible. They may be repatriated or otherwise.
Reverend Joshua Messick, Executive Director of the Baltimore International Seafarers Center. Reverend, thanks.
Thank you, sir.
Labor shortages are affecting companies across the U.S. The National Association of Manufacturers says for many of its members, attracting and retaining employees is the number one challenge. In Nebraska, some companies are addressing the problem by focusing on newly arrived refugees and migrants and going the extra mile to get them job ready. Cassidy Arena with Nebraska Public Media has this report.
Nebraska may be best known for its cornfields and football, but it's also the place where workers build subway cars for big cities, sports vehicles, and even basketball hoops. Manufacturing is big in Nebraska. It's the second largest industry behind agriculture. But it's been hard to find people to fill those manufacturing jobs, especially in a state where the unemployment rate is 2.5%. Kawasaki is one of the state's major employers. Kevin Matron is the training administrator.
It's been a struggle recruiting people. So we've had to look at, I hate the term, but, you know, think out of the box.
So now in Lincoln, Nebraska, there's a program of entry-level manufacturing classes that are taught in the native language of newcomers. Alla Polishuk took those classes and is now a line worker at Kawasaki. She fled Ukraine when Russia invaded 2 years ago.
Alla is saying the job saved her life, and then she really likes to be in the community and spend time with the people that gets her mind off of the current situation in Ukraine.
These are not typical ESL or English as a second language efforts. The coordinator of these classes, Chloe Higgins, says they are instead an effort to address the city's labor shortage and connect refugees to good-paying jobs they typically might not have access to.
There are a number of talent pools in Lincoln specifically that are really unreached. And one of those talent pools is immigrant and refugee populations.
Just under 2 million people live in Nebraska. More than 7% are foreign-born. And in recent years, Nebraska has led the country in refugee arrivals per capita. Many are from the Middle East.
Today, I just wanted to talk about the types of jobs that we offer at Kawasaki.
Recruiter Alicia Teinert is a guest speaker for this class. The instructor, Amir Wali, interprets in Arabic. And he gestures to his assistant, who begins speaking in Kurdish. Refugees like Yusra Taha hope this class will open opportunities for her and her son. She's a single mom from Iraq and says language barriers have made finding work difficult.
I am participating to learn more skills to apply for jobs. My son and I are going through difficult situations. We have already had 4 difficult months.
Teacher Wally says when he arrived from Iraq, the class was in English. He says it's a valuable shortcut for participants to learn about work in their own language.
I myself went through a lot of struggles because I wasn't able to find a good advisor or someone who would tell me what I need to do. If I meet someone like myself in 2008 or 2009, I may have a different position today.
In the class, the students pepper Wally with questions. They want to prepare for the last day of class, job fair day. Wally and other interpreters will help the graduates apply for jobs with the manufacturers, where they'll be considered for direct hire. For NPR News, I'm Cassidy Arena, Lincoln, Nebraska.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. Glad you're with us. It is 8:42. Got 18 minutes left in the program and still a couple more stories to get to, including an interesting one about a look at the history of Easter Monday at the Smithsonian National Zoo and how it became a tradition for Black families in Washington, D.C. Plus, we'll hear a story from Oregon about learning loss after COVID. That's all coming up still this hour on WPR.
Hi there, it's Rachel Martin from NPR News. I am proud to work with stations around the country, including WPR, to bring you news that you can trust. We search out the backstory, give voice to the diversity of our nation, question along with you, and share moments of beauty, moments of joy. This comprehensive reporting is possible thanks to listener contributions. Be a part of this important work when you give at WPR.org. Thanks.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Kimberly-Clark, known for products like Kleenex, Huggies, and Kotex. Proud to be a Wisconsin-based company with a commitment to delivering its purpose of providing better care for a better world.
Support for WGTD's local news and public affairs commitment comes from Casey Family Options, a tradition of trust. For more information, including how to get started in pre-planning, visit caseyfamilyoptions.com or call 262-653-0667.
In public radio. At 8:44, here's a look at what's happening in news. Israel says its military has withdrawn from Gaza's largest hospital after a 2-week raid in which it says it killed some 200 militants. The UN Health Agency said more than 20 patients died and dozens more were put at risk during the raid. A 200-ton piece of the Francis Scott Key Bridge was removed from the debris field, clogging entry to the Port of Baltimore yesterday. This, as the captain of the port says, they're prepping to open a temporary channel nearby. AT&T says it has begun notifying millions of customers about the theft of personal data recently discovered online. They said that the social security numbers for about 7.6 million current AT&T customers and 65 million former account holders were exposed. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Angie, dedicated to helping homeowners find skilled pros to get their home projects done well. From everyday repairs to dream remodels, reviews, pricing, and booking are at Angie.com or on the Angie app. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Louisiana hasn't executed anyone since 2010, but that could change under a new law signed by Governor Jeff Landry that expands execution methods beyond lethal injection. Here's Molly Ryan from WRKF in Baton Rouge.
In 1995, a man named Todd Wessinger shot and killed two people at a restaurant in Baton Rouge. One of them was 27-year-old Stephanie Gazzardo, whose father, Wayne, testified before the legislature in February.
We have a recording of her on 911, begging, had already given him the money. He walked in, shot her dead in cold blood.
2 years after he killed Gazzardo, a jury sentenced Wessinger to death. He's exhausted all of his appeals, but Wayne Gazzardo says he hasn't shown remorse. I met Stephanie's parents, Wayne and Carol Gazzardo, at a busy restaurant to hear more about their story.
We've been fighting it for 28 years. We're not going away. We are not going anywhere. If I die, my wife's going to carry it on. As my wife dies, my son's going to carry it on. If he dies, the rest of my family will be there.
The couple testified multiple times in support of a bill that expands execution methods in Louisiana.
We've been accused of being revengeful. Well, we don't want no revenge. We want justice for our daughter. That's all we want. We've been asking for it.
Louisiana hasn't executed anyone since 2010. In part, that's because the state had a Democratic governor for the past 8 years who opposed the death penalty. And it's also been difficult for the state to get materials for a lethal injection, the only approved method of execution, because many companies refuse to supply them. That's part of the reason lawmakers said they passed a bill to add two other methods, electrocution and gassing, also known as nitrogen hypoxia. And new Republican Governor Jeff Landry signed it, a signal that the state could soon start up executions again. Landry said at a press conference the state owes that to the victims of crime.
When we fail to abide by our promises and our contractual obligations to victims out there, how can we go around and say that we have any credibility on anything else that we do?
The Gazzardos attended the signing and praised Landry. But nitrogen hypoxia has only been used once before. That was in Alabama earlier this year, and it went poorly, according to Dr. Joel Zivin, an anesthesiologist at Emory University who studies the death penalty.
It was, by all accounts, a prolonged, tortuous kind of event. There was struggling and straining and possibly a seizure and possibly vomiting.
And anti-death penalty advocates say the state's headed in the wrong direction.
Where else in the criminal justice system do we ever imitate the behavior of the criminal in determining the punishment?
That's Sister Helen Prejean. She's a Louisiana native and author of best-selling book Dead Men Walking, where she writes about her work as a spiritual advisor for death row inmates. She's accompanied seven people to their executions, and she advocates for ending the death penalty. 12 people on Louisiana's death row have been exonerated in the last 50 years. And Prejean says the risk of killing an innocent person isn't worth it.
We're human. We're frail. We're fallible. We make mistakes. Why not put the death penalty down? Who needs it?
There are currently about 60 people on death row in Louisiana. No one is yet scheduled to be executed. For NPR News, I'm Molly Ryan in Baton Rouge.
This is NPR News.
And this is WPR. So glad you're with us. We got about 11 minutes left in the show, and both of those interesting stories we just talked about still coming up, including that Easter Monday tradition. And by the way, if you're looking for a little bit more news, maybe something focused on Wisconsin, I encourage you to download our daily news podcast, Wisconsin Today. We record it bright and early each and every morning, so you get the very latest news delivered to your podcast feed. Just search Wisconsin Today wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. A trusted resource since 1999, the ADRC is a no-cost, one-stop shop for older people, adults with disabilities, and their families. For more information, call 262-605-6646.
For tours, photo ops, and free swag. Find details and links to all open house activities at wpr.org/presents.
It's Morning Edition on WPR. In sports, the men's Final Four is set in the NCAA March Madness Tournament, NC State playing Purdue, while Alabama plays top-seeded UConn. On the women's side, NC State's in the Final Four as well. South Carolina's there, too. The two other Elite Eight games are tonight, including a rematch of last year's championship with LSU versus Iowa. After that, it's UConn versus USC. The Brewers beat the Mets yesterday, the crew getting the day off today before tomorrow's home opener against the Minnesota Twins, and the Milwaukee Bucks beat the Atlanta Hawks over the weekend. They'll take on the Washington Wizards in D.C. tomorrow night at 6. In weather, it'll be clear to start the day today, but we could see some rain in southern Wisconsin later on. It'll be highs in the 40s across the state today. Precipitation starts falling once again tomorrow. It'll be a wintry mix later on in the day. This is WPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The pandemic may seem like it's in the rearview mirror, but students and teachers continue to feel its impact. The federal government has invested billions of dollars in recent years to address learning loss. And a recent study from Harvard and Stanford shows that while students have made gains, those gains have been uneven. Kadia Riddle reports from Oregon, where many school districts ranked among the lowest on this measure.
Meet future rock star, Judah Moisen. He plays bass.
So it's called Siblings of War. It's a punk rock band that I made up with some kids at school.
They want to be kind of like Green Day, he says, except their band will be made up of 10-year-olds instead of old guys. He's written out the names of their future songs on a post-it note.
The first song on it is going to be named Priority, and the second one is Feeding Frenzy.
Making up these song names seems like a small thing, but just the act of writing them down shows progress for Judah. His mom, Jane Moisen, says during the pandemic, they abandoned the online learning platform the school gave them.
We had, you know, the little red dot that said 157 at one point.
Missing assignments.
Yes, yes.
Judah was still reading and doing math at home. His mom wasn't too worried, but she didn't realize he wasn't writing enough. When he got back to school, he really struggled.
The worksheets were going back to his teacher with these kind of flippant answers because Judah wasn't feeling maybe confident in writing out his thinking. Mm-hmm. So he was sort of like having this attitude of, this is dumb anyway, right, Judah?
It was kind of sad. Like, I couldn't express my ideas like mom was saying.
Judah started to get defiant in school. He was self-conscious around his peers. Then this year, his parents hired a tutor. He's made a lot of progress. High dosage tutoring. It's one thing experts say works to catch kids up. But what about kids here who don't have parents who can pay for it?
Something that I noticed is that they have a very hard time focusing.
Amaro Lovato teaches in a Portland suburb called Gresham. Other states invested in programs to provide widespread tutoring for kids who need it. That happened in some places in Oregon, but not all. Many of her students are low income.
They don't know how to handle frustration.
Lovato teaches second grade. The kids she has this year were preschool age in the pandemic. She says even with kids this young, she can still see significant delays in their social and emotional development. That leads to academic delays.
One-to-one tutoring, it could be very effective, but we don't have enough staff to do that.
Unlike some other states, Oregon gave individual school districts a lot of latitude to decide how to spend federal recovery money. Thomas Kane is a researcher at Harvard. He worked on the study evaluating different states' efforts.
It's almost as if, like, just imagine if during the pandemic, the federal government had just distributed dollars to local public health departments and said to them, okay, you guys figure out your own solution to the pandemic.
Schools had to juggle a lot during the pandemic, figuring out remote learning, monitoring students' emotional well-being, thinking about their safety. Kane says Oregon didn't give its schools firm directives on how much they should set aside to address learning loss or the best practices for doing so.
Like there would have been some communities, you know, implemented more effective strategies than others.
Teacher training is another thing that experts say helped to catch kids up in other states. That was also less consistent here. Jackie Ayala is a second grade teacher. She points to a board of sticky notes in her classroom. After that day's math lesson, each student had to write one addition problem and put it on the wall.
This kind of helps me to see who gets it.
It's a quick assessment, but it gives her invaluable information that helps her make sure kids don't slip through the cracks. She didn't learn this strategy in Oregon, though. She learned it when she was working in another state. She says her colleagues here just haven't had the same opportunities.
I knew this math program because I used it in my last district, but I was told that because it was a pandemic that there wasn't that training.
It was a tough time for folks.
Dr. Charlene Williams is the director of the Oregon Department of Education. She says educators everywhere struggled to figure out how to prioritize spending with lots of needs during the pandemic.
They had to make some hard decisions.
There was a lot of guesswork. But she says, like the rest of the country, the state has learned from this stress test.
While we know that our data does not tell a good story, we also know what it takes in order to start getting students what they need.
Oregon has started a new statewide summer learning program, as well as an early literacy initiative. Williams says it's an effort by the state to reach not just some students, all students. For NPR News, I'm Katie Riddle in Portland, Oregon.
Yesterday, the Easter Bunny may have paid a visit to a celebration near you, but today, the Easter Panda is likely to appear at the Smithsonian National Zoo in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, the zoo's Easter Monday celebration dates back to the 1890s, and it's a tradition for generations of African-American families.
There's a really lovely 1936 photograph of children that are gathered and kind of dressed to their nines in double-breasted suits and dresses and wool overcoats and bows and ties and hats.
That's Dominic Donjelly, a PhD student at the University of Iowa. He says the origins of celebrating Easter Monday at the zoo are actually a little murky.
Some attribute the origins of the celebration to the fact that the White House Easter egg hunt began in 1878 and was de facto segregated.
Others say that it was because many Black people were required to work on Easter Sunday, so Monday was chosen to celebrate with family.
And that celebration became significant and meaningful, and it was a holiday that then would become shared across generations.
By the early 20th century, the event was well established. In 1914, the zoo reported that Easter Monday was its busiest day of the year with nearly 57,000 visitors. In 2011, the zoo partnered with the National Museum of African American History and Culture to honor the tradition.
And in addition to the more kind of traditional activities like picnicking and the Easter egg roll, they also included programming that highlighted many different facets of Black and African-American culture in North America.
Now, this year, the event is billed by the Smithsonian as a Washington family tradition, complete with an Easter scavenger hunt and special animal demonstrations.
So if you do make it to the zoo today, keep an eye out for a panda with bunny ears. This is NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Alex Crow, and that'll do it for today's show. Thanks for joining us for Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. And as always, big thanks to John Davis, who helps bring us the news. That news is on the way.
Support for WPR comes from the Bolt Company, a family and employee-owned company dedicated to providing construction, technical, and real estate solutions in a variety of markets nationwide. Featured projects and more at Bolt.com.
Support for WGTD comes from the Racine Theatre Guild, presenting Stargirl, a coming-of-age story based on the Jerry Spinelli novel about staying true to yourself. On stage April 12th to the 21st. More at racinetheatre.org. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News.